Welcome back to the Religious Studies Project. This podcast follows on directly from my interview with James Cox, broadcast earlier this week, on the subject of the world religions paradigm. And if you don't know what that is, you should go and check out that podcast first. This is also the fourth of our compilation episodes. And this time, the question we asked was, what happens after the world's religions paradigm? Can we teach religious studies, especially at the beginning levels, without resorting to fact files about Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism, and so on? And if there is a way, what is it? How do we do it? The interview starts with Professor Cox himself setting out his hopes and some possible avenues for how this might be achieved, and also some of his own experiences in trying to find another way. We then move across the Atlantic, where Mark Jurgensmeyer, Peter Baer, and Craig Martin tell us about some of the approaches they've used and the relative success or otherwise that they've had, and the response that they've had to these attempts. Back in Britain, Suzanne Owen changes the approach slightly by presenting some of her own experiences in teaching RS based on alternative or indigenous religions, mostly Druidry and North American Native religion in her case, and some of the resistance that we get and how tied up the world religions paradigm is with the public perception of what religions are, the faiths of the world and so on. And then finally, the last 10 minutes or so are given over to Stephen Sutcliffe from here in Edinburgh, who initially suggested this the idea of this podcast to us, who reflects on the problems, more specifically in the UK, and his own call to arms, really, for this to be something that we come together as a scholarly community to address. So, without further ado, I'll pass you over to James Cox.
I think it is possible, but it's not easy. It's possible if we can begin with a sort of theoretical or methodological critique. I know this is quite difficult in first-year students who come with many expectations that we're going to study various religions in certain discrete ways. But nonetheless, I think it's helpful if we could begin with the critique of the whole idea of religion itself. Now, having said that, what we would then need to do would be to emphasize that religions are... The term itself, of course, is problematic, but religions themselves, if we continue to use the term, have local and specific variations, that they are practiced and understood in multiple ways. However, to study such multiple ways or divergent patterns is virtually impossible, unless what we want to do is to create libraries full of specific, concrete, particular studies. So we also need to have some sort of categories, some sort of generic ways in which we can discuss the ways in which human beings respond to or reflect or have some kind of aspiration towards what I've called, in my definition of religion, alternate realities. So perhaps we need, rather than, as we've done at Edinburgh, choose to give the theory and method course in year two, we need to be more discriminating and expose students immediately to the problems that we have in the study of religion. That would be one approach. Now, when... Of course, I've been teaching this for a long time, and in the 90s, when I was in religious studies with my colleagues, Alistair Key and Nick Wyatt and Frank Whaling, we sat down and had a meeting about this and said, is there not some way we can get out of this? Because we teach all these separate traditions. We teach Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, primal religions, as they called it in those days. Is there not some way we can get out of it? We discussed this and decided that we would try a thematic approach. Okay, we're going to try to look at, find a theme that would enable us to understand an element within different traditions. So we chose, I don't know why we chose it, but it was chosen, space and time, okay, and selected religious traditions. Of course, you can't get much more philosophical than space and time, but nonetheless, we tried this. And so our first year course was space and time in selected religious traditions. Now, I taught the section, by that time, I think we called it indigenous religions, and I looked at selected indigenous religions. I looked at the Yoruba in Nigeria, mm-hmm, particularly at their shrines to the Orisha, and tried to understand how space and time were related. I then took from my own field experience in Zimbabwe and discussed particular rituals with respect to the two sacred mountains that were around the area where I was doing my research, the rituals that took place, the spirit mediums that were communicating to the community about important matters to them, particularly with the drought and rain, which had political and economic consequences and so on. So we tried to do that. Nonetheless, I think we did not overcome the problem because we still had to speak in terms of Hindu religious traditions, Buddhist religious traditions, African or indigenous religious traditions, space and time in these. There have been other textbooks that have tried to do this in other ways. For example, the Woodhead volume that talks about includes, and also John Hinnells had a section in his New Handbook of Living Religions dealing with issues like feminism, the role of women, in other words, in religions, political concerns, and these sorts of things. But notice I still use the word in the world religions. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's very, very difficult to get out of some way in which we can speak generically about traditions that, if we are able to clue students in to the problematic character of the term religion and the problematic character of the world religions, it seems to me that we can utilize specific, concrete, and particular studies to illustrate the diversity in religions, but also some of the ways in which we can do comparative studies generically around rituals, perhaps rites of passage or rites of entering into adulthood as it through marriage and sorts of things like that, or look at ways in which stories, oral traditions, and scriptural traditions relate and that sort of thing. But I know that's not horribly innovative, and it's not solving the problem, but I think the first thing we have to do is to dispel students of their naive understandings about what it is we mean by religion and how we study religions and what we might mean by these generic terms.
Is there another better way that we could be approaching?
Well,
teaching
the department
religion?
I'm part of, we don't do that.
What? Right? Well, wonderful.
we have the world religions courses, of course, and yeah, they're core courses. And at, in the upper undergraduate level, we have courses in single traditions, but they're not even offered with any kind of regularity. We put so little emphasis on it. The staff is not hired according to, you know, what religion are you a specialist in, right? We don't have an Islam expert and a Judaism expert and, you know, the et cetera, et cetera. We have people who know quite a bit about some of these religions, but that's not why they're here. They're here, frankly, for their methodological specialization. So our approach, and I think it's a very valid approach, is to take sociological, anthropological, psychological, philosophical, historical approaches to religion, methodological ones, disciplinary ones, And then only after that decide what religious content informs these courses.
Yeah.
And that's the way we've been doing it, and it's a model that fits very comfortably with me. I teach no course that has the name of a religion in it.
Wow.
But the words social and society are there all the time.
All the time.
Because that's my methodological specialization. I'm a sociologist.
Sure. I've taught the introduction to religion class at Berkeley for 15 years. And it was a three-term sequence. And I taught the introduction differently each term. One, the study of religion. One was thematically. But the third, the one of most interest to me, was the course that used to be called World Religion. And I taught it even then as Global Religion. And that is, rather than saying, it's Tuesday, it must be Islam, it's you know, it's Friday, it must be Buddhism. Rather, I taught the course as a kind of narrative structure of starting with the Babylonians and how religious traditions emerge and intertwine and interact, and you know, the Semitic religions and the whole Mediterranean context and the culture, and then Christianity coming out of Judaism, but then having all of these Mithra and Zoroastrian and Greek influences, and then being a part of Europe with all of these pagan elements that become so much a standard part of what we think of Christianity. So, you know, this is a tradition that's, you know, it's kind of like walking through a field of thistles and having all these things still clunk onto it. Christianity is a tradition with a lot of things clumped onto it, and every religious tradition is like that and interacts like that. And so to tell that story was enormous fun, and one that I believed in as a scholar, because I think you always should teach something you believe in, and that you have something, a story that you want to tell, and some an idea that you want students, maybe just one central idea. And if it's that one central idea, it's that religious is an expression of the human condition and the interaction of peoples. And it's an emerging, growing, organic thing, and not just a static repository of ideas and symbols in one location. And you can tell that story with a lot of fun, and with slides, and with all the things that undergraduates like to see and expect to see, in a way that's not cumbersome. That is, it doesn't need to go into an enormous amount of detail, because if you're telling that story, you don't need to tell everything about everything. You know, let them, you know, find out about the pillars of Islam somewhere else. You want to tell them about how Islam as a tradition emerged out of the Middle East and has these resonances of Christianity and Judaism, and how then it developed into North Africa and Europe. And I mean, that's a broader story that you want to tell, and it's a lot more fun.
Hi, my name is Craig Martin. I'm an assistant professor of religious studies at St. Thomas Aquinas College, which is a small liberal arts school near New York City. I've been asked to say a few words about how I organize my introductory course in a way that's not organized around world religions. My intro course, the way that I've designed it, is oriented around a number of critical questions and a number of critical concepts. In the first lecture I give students, I ask them to reflect on what sociologists and cultural studies people have said about this set of questions. How have the elements or cultural tools in religious traditions or cultural traditions in general, how have they been used to reflect and reinforce inside or outside or group boundaries? How have they been used to reflect and reinforce social hierarchies within communities, or last of desired behaviors or social norms in communities? The first example that I give them, or one of the first examples, is I pass out a selection from one of the Rig Veda passages where Purusha is divided up. Purusha is this, you know, giant god-like character who's killed by the gods and divided up, sacrificed, and his mouth is turned into the priests, his arms are turned into the warriors, his feet are turned into servants, and so on. And I point out that, you know, this is not just a creation story. It's not simply how some group a long time ago, they didn't just make this up about how the world was created. In fact, what they did was that they took the the existing social order and embedded it in this story in order to sacralize that or naturalize it or perhaps supernaturalize it. So, you know, the story, again, it's not just a creation story. It's a story that reflects and reinforces a set of social hierarchies and also a set of social norms, right? Each class that's identified in this creation story has a particular role. Farmers are expected to farm. Warriors are expected to fight. Now, of course, that story may not serve that sort of social function in all types of communities in which it's read, but it's almost certain that in the community in which this was originally written and originally received, it probably did serve the social function of reinforcing the community social structure. Later on in the course, near the end of the course, I have my students read Charles Sheldon's novel, In His Steps. This novel originally appeared in 1896 or 1897. In the story, this is the story that is the kind of origin of this What Would Jesus Do fad that we saw a resurgence of in the 80s and 90s. The characters in this novel ask themselves, what would Jesus do? And they decide, they form a pact where they're going to do whatever they think the answer to that question is. They're going to follow through on that for the next year. And it turns out that what they decide to do ends up reflecting and reinforcing certain class differences. There's a clear professional class in the novel, and then there is working class people. And one of the biggest problems with the working class people is that they drink alcohol, and alcohol is the boogeyman of this of the novel. All the characters gather together not only to help the working class but to save the working class from alcohol. They try to institute prohibition in their town. And by the time we get to the end of the parts of the novel that we read, it's pretty straightforwardly obvious that Sheldon's not just asking what would Jesus do, and what he's doing with Jesus probably has very little to do with what a first century Palestinian Jew might have said. Instead, it's a story that embeds a series of 19th century class differences in the novel and reinforces them in ways that are tied to the authority of Jesus for 19th century or late 19th century Christians. And also there's a social agenda of prohibition in the novel. Now, of course, Charles Sheldon wasn't successful in and of himself in bringing about prohibition, but it's because of the social agenda embedded in stories like this that things like prohibition eventually came about in the United States, you know, 20 or so years later. So, you know, one of the guiding types of questions that I have for my course is taken from some of the things that Bruce Lincoln has read, where he asks, you know, when reading any text, the pertinent questions are, who is trying to convince whom of what in this text? What are the consequences should the readers be persuaded, right? What are the social stakes? Who wins, who loses, and what do they win and what do they lose? And I approach all the content that we look at in the course around these types of questions. Now, I make it clear to the students that these are not the only questions that one could ask of the material, and in addition, they're not even representative of religious studies as a whole. However, my argument both to them and to myself, you know, how do I justify this to myself, is that they're going to be exposed to more stereotypical approaches to religious studies probably throughout their life, through popular culture, through things that they might pick up at a popular bookstore. They will probably only get exposed to this kind of more critical approach for the one semester that I have them. And if during that one semester, I'd rather ask those critical questions than to reinforce something that they're going to get for the rest of their life anyway. So it should be clear that, you know, my course is not oriented around world religions. And, you know, if I've chosen Charles Sheldon's In His Steps or a passage from the Rig Veda, or we actually read the Bhagavad Gita, it's not because I'm looking for a representative example of Christianity or of Hinduism. It's because I think that these examples illustrate interesting answers to the questions that I'm posing to the students. At the end of the day, what I'm doing in this class is arguably giving the students a vulgar Marxist introduction to the study of religion, but I'm okay with that.
Religious studies becomes a problem, the name becomes a problem, when you're actually going beyond what is obviously or has accepted in society as religion. And I think that's a good thing, and I think in saying that there are some scholars who are defining religion or educating about whether a certain group is religious or not, perhaps for court, or sorry, for legal purposes. They may say that Scientology is not religion, or that it is. But how much influence that has on the legal processes depends on the case, in any case. And this is a whole other issue about whether something can be accepted as religion from the side of society, about whether or not it is threatening or not.
I think actually if you don't include an example which is a marginal case when you're teaching people about what religion is or isn't, then you never engage that debate as to what it is. I find that when you get to you bring in Wicca or New Age or something like that, where the boundary is a little bit fuzzy, that's where you get the debate. Otherwise, if you just bring in, you're comparing Christianity to Hinduism or whatever, you know, everybody, you know, there's people there that are going to be part of those faiths. There's no debate about what a world religion is. But if you bring in something marginal, even better, you bring in something which is, you know, Scientology or the Church of All Worlds, which has an obviously sort of invented element to it, then that really gets people interested and they can get engaged in that debate.
And I think that's absolutely essential why we need to look at these traditions, our emergences, to help them challenge the categories that we're using and to take us away from this in a circle that we're engaged in, our own language, our own categories, and we never really see what we're doing anymore until we start to look at maybe the Lakota, and they may challenge us, you know, a Native American group, or say a pagan group, or Church of All Worlds, or one of these groups that then can actually challenge our assumptions, and they actually help our subject evolve. Mm. Well, I don't want to use that word, evolve.
Move forward. I mean, yeah, because in the end, is religious education there just to teach facts? You know, is it there just so that people can come out going, I know a lot about Islam, I know a lot about Hinduism, or is it there to, you know, understanding of categories and the way people work and the way we classify things, the way people deal with things, and I think that's much more beneficial than learning the facts about
the kind of
accepted things.
What's going on in religious education, particularly recently, came out of the multicultural project. And so they thought people ought to know about what religions are doing and believe, and so that when they go into society, they, you know, when they meet a Sikh, they know what they believe and what they do. But of course, they might meet a Sikh, you know, at university, whatever, and they're not part of the Khalsa, and they're not wearing a turban, and they're not doing everything that they learned in school about what they think a Sikh should do or be. And it becomes a problem then, because what have they just learned? They've learned a particular model based on perhaps how Christians view religion, or not all Christians, obviously, just the British ones. And it also is promoting a kind of extreme version of each of these religious traditions. Yeah,
very reified versions.
Yes.
I mean, you know, you've got these kids sitting and they're learning this fact file about what Catholics do. They go home and say, oh, what were you learning about in school today? Oh, we were learning about Catholics. You are a Catholic. All right. You know?
Yeah. And they don't even have a Bible in the house.
Yeah.
And quite a lot of them don't.
Yeah.
No, I think that is one of the problems that I think the type of religious education that is under that banner. But there's another thing that's been going on too, is to do with citizenship and creating a good citizen. And so they're trying to morally influence children to behave through religious education. And I think that is a real problem, because in some ways all the subjects are geared towards that. So whether they're learning literature or art or anything, there is that kind of agenda that they want them to become good citizens and to become to participate in society in healthy ways, or according to
the fact that it's even called religious and moral education, it says so much about
in Scotland. It's really apparent.
There's no continuity between that and then what you do at university in the first year.
There's a different agenda there.
It's what's perceived as the financial benefit of teaching religion in schools is producing a good citizen, isn't it?
That's how I reduce the whole idea of religious education. I'm sure it doesn't.
£1 per pupil, wasn't that the fee that came out?
Less than, I think,
And many people come into religious studies in university with the same ideas that they want to go into, kind of interfaith type view of the world.
Yeah,
and continue to create peace and love and I'm being a bit facetious there. They want to understand religious intolerance, they want to understand violence and war, and so they think studying religions is going to help bring peace in the world. There is that attitude, I think, but that's not the only one.
Okay, well, I suppose the first thing I think is that any kind of coming to terms with teaching problems in religious studies, and particularly the problems of the world religions paradigm in teaching, needs to be put in the wider context, I think, of coming up with a more positive program now for the study of religions. I mean, in some ways, we're needing to come to terms with what we're going to do in, if you like, a post-deconstructionist world. We've had maybe, well, at least 20, if not more, years. I mean, maybe a generation and a half or more of really good scholarship that has deconstructed the field and taken the field apart, taken our core category religion apart, increasingly taken apart the taxonomy of entities that we most regularly deal with or most self-evident in our field, the world religions paradigm that we've been talking about. And we know how to take these things apart. What we're less sure about, I think, is what we put in their place and what we use as the building blocks for a new curriculum to which we can introduce our students and from which we can also create a platform to secure our intellectual status and our clout in modern research university. So I think that's the big challenge. What do we do after deconstruction, if you like? Not that deconstruction is finished and over for good, but what do we do alongside then, if you like, deconstruction? What do we do as a more positive program? What are we actually going to enjoin our students to learn and to deal with as the raw data or the raw material of what they would be dealing with in the study of religion? So I think that's the first thing that I would want to say. And I think it's going to be a big task, and I don't think we should kid ourselves that this is going to be easy. We've had, you know, depending on how you construct the history of the field, we've had, you know, 100 years from the late Victorians of setting up the world religions paradigm. If you take Jonathan Z. Smith's argument that Cornelius Tyler's account in the Encyclopedia Britannica of the so-called universal or world religions is really that first moment in the modern period of study where we get this trope of world religions up and running. Well, then we've had 100 years of this, and we're not going to be able to turn the line around so easily just in a couple of years' time. It's going to take time to do that. And of course, the other thing is, the world religions, in a sense, do have a factual existence now. They've come to become self-evident entities that everyone knows what they are. Our students come to us already prepared to know what Hinduism, Buddhism, Sikhism, Judaism, etc. are as somehow real entities in the world. And, you know, state legislatures and educational systems and legal systems, in a sense, recognize versions of these entities. So we can't disinvent them as well. They're up and running in the world as facts that confront us. So it's going to be a tough task to deal with the situation and to come up with more subtle and more variegated ways, perhaps, of teaching and researching religious formations in the modern world in this light. And I think one of the other issues or problems that we've got, if you like, is we've got competing enthusiasms in the field as a whole as to where we might put our energies. So in many ways, this question of how we're going to teach even our immediate first level students is also bound up with our sense of the disciplinary shape of the field. So we've got, as is well known, big enthusiasms for cognitive science, which has taken up the imaginations of many of our colleagues and had them steaming away on programs that, you know, radically reconfigure the study of religion as a cognitivist endeavour. And this has created a certain kind of polarisation in the field. So we've got other folk who are very resistant to that and are very much signed up to a culturalist agenda of all kinds of suspicions of the supposed scientism of the cognitivist enterprise. So I think there is an impulse, you know, to come up with a new positive a moment in the study of religion to complement and take forward the field after deconstructionism, but it can end up being polarized in different kinds of ways, which can set up a new set of tensions in a field that, you know, has only so much energy and capacity for doing the work that it has to do. You know, we're not superhuman. We're very limited. We're working in a very restricted, in many ways, materialist field. So I think the first thing I'd want to say really is, let's not kid ourselves of the scope of the task ahead of us. It's going to be tough, and I think that also means that it's got to be a task that we pursue collaboratively. The humanities and the social sciences have historically been known for their ego-driven scholarship, the idea of, you know, isolated scholars labouring away on their own. But I really do think to crack some of these problems, particularly in the study of religion, we're going to have to work hard at collective, collegial programmes together if we're going to be able to make the kinds of inroads that we want to do. I think if I was going to think of a more positive program of how to go about this, then, having sketched out some of the difficulties that face us and the problems in turning a good ship religious studies round, turning the line around, if you like, I'd have to go and think to some of my own first year teaching in religious studies. So thinking of introductory course that we teach in Edinburgh, and we teach two courses. We teach a course in the first semester, which has been renamed Lived Religions, and the second semester course is now called Global Religions. And one might say, well, it sounds like, you know, just rearranging the furniture a bit, you know, the very trope of global sounds like world religions under new management. That's not entirely true. I mean, I'll speak about the second semester course, the Global Religions course, because that's what I'm involved with, and I'll just describe what I do there and how, in its own kind of modest way, it might offer a different kind of, slightly different kind of approach to modelling religious formations. So what I do the last few weeks of the course. I do 3 weeks, and I do a section really that's historically and culturally based, and the focus is on the situation, broadly speaking, in Europe, more or less after the Second World War, and it's about the coming of new forms of religion, new forms of religious expression, but within a historical and cultural context, and a particular focus on the 1960s and the aftermath of the 1960s. So I focus on two main case studies. I focus on the emergence of Wicca, neo-pagan or pagan witchcraft, but I don't focus on so much, you know, Wicca as a new religion, as it were, and more on the historiographical questions of Wicca. Is it a new form of religion, or is it, as many of the early activists were claiming, somehow the re-emergence of pagan witchcraft, pre-Christian witchcraft that had gone underground in the great witchcraft persecutions and was now, you know, finally re-emerging as conditions were changing. So I try and introduce the students there to questions about history and historiography and how a tradition might imaginatively narrate its own past. So that's one thing. And then the other case study I do is about this nebulous, in many ways nebulous, but very real field of New Age or holistic spirituality, which is where I originally did my doctoral research. And there I use the Findhorn community, where I've done some field work in the past and some archival research, and I use Paul Hillis and Linda Woodhead's work on mapping the expression of holistic beliefs and practices in the small market town of Kendal in England. I use these as case studies, again, not so much to talk about new religions and New Age movements, but to talk about the way that certain kinds of sensibilities, beliefs and practices are represented in everyday life settings, out with the kind of more formal contexts and institutions that we come to expect religion to be taking its shape within, you see. So I'm trying to sort of, if you like, in both of these case studies, in the case of Wicca, more in a historical or historiographical framework in the case of New Age and holistic stuff in a more ethnographic everyday sense. I'm trying to show that maybe, you know, the boundaries of the religious bleed over into culture, into also the secular everyday world. And I try and invite the students, if you like, to see these as primary formations of religion, as just compelling and, if you like, ripe for theorization as any of the more obvious self-evident entities that most of them come to us expecting to find. I think it is a struggle, though, in that I think my sense, having taught this material about Wicca and New Age holistic spirituality over several years here now, my sense is that only a very small number of students actually get it, actually really grasp what you're trying to say. I find, and it can be dispiriting. I find that many people, in terms of the questions the students ask, are clearly struggling to think that this is, if you like, proper religion. That's particularly the case with New Age and the holistic spirituality field. You know, it can so easily be seen as being somehow superficial and lightweight, and somehow the froth of popular culture, however hard one struggles to present it in a different kind of way, because the students are already so thoroughly pre-primed, so thoroughly imbued with a self-evident sense of what is proper religion, what is real religion. So you're always struggling against that. And when it comes to the material about Wicca and witchcraft, you're struggling with the exotic, spectacular expectations, which in many ways, of course, some of the, you know, the activists, the pioneers like Gardner himself were playing and teasing their audiences with. But the students, you know, find it difficult to get beyond the sort of colourful, exotic, you know, occult paraphernalia that come with the witchcraft material. So you can find yourself, I mean, I find myself struggling often to try and keep the attention of the students who struggle with this material and maybe want to get more of the world religions paradigm packaged their way. And there's even a temptation to play to that gallery sometimes, if only so you can maybe hope you can smuggle in some ideas for later on. But you struggle with that kind of weight of expectations, I think, and those who grasp, you know, what you're getting at in terms of the diffusion of this material into everyday culture and out with the traditional boundaries of the religious realm. And I don't say that to say that, you know, there may not be problems with my teaching style that, you know, don't help that. I mean, this is, I think, increasingly a challenge for us. We have to, in the UK educational system, more and more actively teach and deliver a certain kind of pre-packaged, pre-digested product to our students because of various complex developments in the educational system. So it's not to say that my own teaching couldn't be doing this better. I'm not trying to ignore that pedagogical challenge, if you like. But I am saying that there's always conceptually, intellectually, that certain kind of set of presuppositions, I think, that you're struggling against. And I think with the best students, you know, it can be a real satisfaction at the end of the honours course here when you see a student perhaps writing in their fourth year dissertation, writing stuff that shows, you know, that the seeds have taken root and they've got what you're talking about, and they can do both the deconstructive stuff as well as the more positive engagement with religious raw materials that I'm suggesting at the end of the day we have to rethink the study of religion as.